This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
We are here live here on Pet Life Radio and Instagram. Here for you, here for your pets. You know the drill. If you have any questions, ask away. I'd already checked with my sister because sometimes I forget, did we cover it or did not cover it? So sometimes people say things during the week and say, oh my God, you got to cover that on the show. And I don't remember all the time if I did. So hello, Sharon, how you doing? So I hope you got the prescription. I called it in. I hope you pick it up. And anyway, so how to get a hold of me? Very easy. Well, if you're here on Instagram, just start typing away because I see you. I'm trying to wave to everybody I can. And if not, if you want to hear on Pet Life Radio, you can just either join me here. Just ask away, ask questions. It comes to me. You can also 877-385-8882. Once again, 877-385-8882. Cat Snippers, hello. And it's great now. My sister is here saying hi. Already said hi to me, but someone else said hi to Bethany. So now she's using me on our show here to talk to other people, which is fine. Love it. The more engagement, the better. The more likely we're going to get some really good questions, subject matter. I could always use some help when it comes to that. Don't think that any weird problem that you have, you're the only one that has this weird problem. It's not the case. Because trust me, there are going to be a lot of people that have, a lot of pet parents have the same things, which is why, interestingly, one of the things, if a dog is acting normal but threw up several times but still ate breakfast, should you worry? So that's actually a great question. Thanks to Vicky at Eloise Pet Rescue. And that is that there are so many reasons for vomiting. There are so many reasons for diarrhea, especially diarrhea with blood. So they're the ones that people freak out. And one thing I like about, in general, telemedicine, air vet, is that sometimes just seeing the dog, watching the dog at work, it is something that it takes a lot of the pressure away, because if a dog even is vomiting, if they're really sick, then you're going to see a dog that's just not happy, is lethargic, is not eating, is maybe having diarrhea as well, is sluggish. Then I'm concerned. But if the dog is not eating or is vomiting, all right, I'm going to give you a classic story in a minute, but they're running around and they can't wait for the next meal. Obviously, they're not that sick. And so now we have to then, a couple of things. Number one is determine, was it vomiting? Was it regurgitation? In other words, what breed is the dog? How long after eating? Was it preceded by upchucking or just all of a sudden they open their mouth and this yellow bile comes out? So this is all really, really stuff that's so important. So anyway, Cat Snippers, we're going to talk about that in a minute. So this is why it's important to see the dog. So chances are, if I have a dog that's happy, alert, playful, active and eating, what I'm going to do is I'm going to assume this. When something comes on suddenly, but really not affecting how sick the dog is, then I'm looking at some insult. Something happened, something eaten. So I'm not that worried, at least yet. So what I would recommend is hold off on food, even water. Once a stomach goes through vomiting, okay, so that stomach is almost like taking a wet rag and wringing it out. That's what the inside of that stomach looks like. So anything that goes into that stomach, even something as benign as water, might make them vomit again. So what I recommend always is to hold off on food. Now, maybe water, obviously water is important. So what I would do is give them some ice cubes. Take about 4 or 5 ice cubes, put them in an empty water bowl. And as the ice melts, they can go up to it and drink some water, but they can't ingest a large volume at once, something that's going to stretch that stomach. Let them wait anywhere from 12 to 24 hours. And then you can go ahead and try a little bit of food, let them eat, maybe a couple of bites to keep it down, maybe an hour later, a little bit more, and slowly work them up. I was involved in a case years ago, and the dog was apparently diagnosed by another veterinarian, I'm not going to give any names, and they wanted to run over $1,000 worth of testing for this little dog that was vomiting. So I'm looking at this dog, comes into my office, I could barely even get it to sit still for a second. So now I start asking questions. Good physical exam and a good history is one of the most important things you can have done. Don't let a veterinarian, based on just a symptom, say, okay, this is what we have to do. Put your hands on the dog. Listen to it. Feel it. Get a really thorough history. What is it? When is it? How long ago? Really get a thorough history. That's very important. So as I'm getting this history, what is it? He wasn't even vomiting. It wasn't even, it was regurgitation. What was the breed? A French bulldog. Duh. They do this a lot. So I'm watching this dog and I said, no, this is regurgitation. This is probably a little esophageal or gastric reflux. And it causes, when does it happen worse? Late night, early morning. Ah, beautiful history. That is supporting what my hunch was. So we said, no testing, no testing. I know people think I'm crazy. Maybe I am. No testing, not yet anyway. So let's try this first. Remember my KISS rule, keep it simple, stupid. I'm going to keep it simple. So we said, okay, I want you to take about a third to a quarter of dinner, set it aside and feed it to the dog, like maybe at 10:30, 11, 10, 15 minutes before you go to bed. Okay. Now, if that alone doesn't work, be about 15 minutes before that, I'll have you give half of a Pepcid or half of a Prilosec. Well, guess what? We never even got to the Pepcid and Prilosec. Just the late night snack solved the problem. No testing. No, very easy. Get a history. Don't let your doctors, whoever they are, that's why I'm so concerned about emergency clinics. If you rush to an emergency for that, which is not an emergency, by the way, in my opinion, 95% of emergencies are not. But you go in there and you have often a young and experienced doctor. They hear vomiting and they freak and they start testing and x-rays and come on. No. Get a good thorough history. Do a good exam. Find out exactly what's coming up, when it's coming up, how long after eating. Is it slowing the dog down? Can the dog wait for its next meal? No, it wants to eat right away. You know it's not serious. So anyway, this is what I recommend is making sure that it may be nothing. So with this dog who's vomiting but running around, try those things first. First of all, what's coming up? How long after eating? Is the dog still can't wait for its next meal? Then, you know, it's probably not very serious. Most likely ate something that affected it. Again, don't jump. Don't jump to the expense of testing and worrying. Don't worry. Okay, let me just get some wave here. Now let's go back to some questions. IVDD. Oh my God, too many good questions. We'll get to y'all. All right, so... there we go. Lymphoma. Is it unwise to do chemo? No, it's not unwise to do chemo. Yes, prednisone is good, but there are some really mild chemo agents that might help. Lomustine for one, vincristine for another. So, I mean, prednisone is certainly part of the protocol. I would rely on just pred. I would want to hit it a little harder, again, depending on so many other factors. What's the cat's age? Okay. How large are the lymph nodes? How were they diagnosed? Were they truly diagnosed with, and you can also do something where they can evaluate the testing and to see whether it's B cell or T cell. B is bad. T is terrible. So that also not only helps determine how aggressive you want to be with chemo, but also gives you a better idea of the prognosis. So there are some additional testing that can be run on samples. You may need to have your doctor take another sample and have them determine if they can actually do a detailed evaluation of the type of lymphoma. And then also as a prognosticating measure, you might want to get some samples, take an ultrasound, maybe get a sample of liver, maybe get a sample of spleen. And it's called, you want to have a better idea. It's called staging the cancer. So if the lungs are clear, and the spleen and liver are clear, and it's a B cell, then I would say your prognosis, you're never going to cure it, but you can really slow it down a lot. Even if it's T cell, you might want to get more aggressive with the chemo. So I would recommend, if your veterinarian is not comfortable doing this, get a consult with a board-certified veterinary oncologist, depending on where you are. You're here in LA, there are a lot of them. You can always reach out to me and I'll give you some names, but it's not an instant death sentence, but I would be a little bit more aggressive than just prednisolone in a cat. All right, so we go back. Does glucosamine really make a difference to a 12-year-old dog? Yes. First of all, it's a supplement. And we don't know what effect it's going to have, how dogs react differently. So I look at it differently. Is it harmful? No, it's not. So if it's not harmful and it may help, capital M, it may help, go for it. You have nothing to lose. And so I would say if a dog, an older dog, that is already not on some sort of joint supplement, I would highly recommend it. Now, interestingly, I'll tell you a study. There was a study done years ago evaluating the joint response via x-ray, which is a little bit touchy. They did not find any advantage on x-ray on these dogs that were given glucosamine. However, what they didn't do, which would have been better, but it was too expensive for the study, is to do MRIs or CTs. That would have given a much better idea of what the problem is. But interestingly, on that study where they took x-rays, they also gave questionnaires to the owners to fill out about how the dog is doing. So maybe it could have been a placebo effect, who knows? But the vast majority, 70%+ of pet parents who were giving their dogs glucosamine, chondroitin, MSM, actually felt their dogs were doing better. So you may not show radiographically, but who cares about the radiograph? Does the dog feel better? Is it making him more energetic? Is he more mobile? Is he getting up faster? Is he more willing to go out for a walk? That's all we care about as pet parents. So in my opinion, I'd go for it. If you have a two-year-old dog, the same leg shakes, what is it? It could be what we call muscle fatigue. It could be some sort of just a muscle twitch. When does it happen? I will tell you that I've seen this and I've done tests and everything comes back normal and the dog and every other guard is normal. It just might be, if it's only one leg, it could be something with the muscle of that leg, but maybe you can try something like methocarbamol, which is a muscle relaxant, but usually it's like muscle fasciculations because of muscle fatigue. Why? I don't know, but I'm not too worried about it. Elderly cat has small cell lymphoma. Okay, so if it's small cell lymphoma, elderly cat, if in doubt, and if it was not staged, I would stage it first. And then certainly you could do prednisolone. Prednisolone, remember in a cat, it's prednisolone, not prednisone. Important. But I would still say something like there are some very mild, even oral medications that you can use along with prednisolone that might be helpful. Autoimmune diseases, Bethany. So yes, dogs can get autoimmune diseases. And the most common one that we see is autoimmune hemolytic anemia. And we also see skin diseases like pemphigus vulgaris, pemphigus foliaceus. You can also get collie nose. Which is also a form of an autoimmune disease, discoid lupus. These are all diseases that dogs can get. They are controllable, treatable, sometimes treatable. It may never go away completely, but the next bout may never happen. For example, autoimmune hemolytic anemia. When we get autoimmune thrombocytopenia, it's rarely primary. So when you have AITP, autoimmune thrombo, that's where the platelet count gets very low because the body eats up its platelets just like it does eat up the red cells with autoimmune hemolytic anemia or immune-mediated thrombocytopenia. So these are all IMHA, immune-mediated hemolytic anemia, or AIHA, so autoimmune hemolytic anemia, just different terms for the same disease. Anyway, we put them on high dose of immunosuppressants, sometimes just high dose steroids, sometimes azathioprine, sometimes cyclosporine. And again, you work with your veterinarian. They are controllable. I've had many cases over the years of AIHA or IMHA, and we got it under control. It never came back. So sometimes when there's some sort of immune stimulation, the body goes wild and it starts not only attacking what it was attacking in the first place, because they have a good immune system, the immune system got too good and started attacking the dog. And we see this a lot of times with the pemphigus cases. Now with those, again, it is controllable, maybe treatable, and you need to get a diagnosis first. So skin biopsies are very important. And when you're doing the skin biopsy, it helps the pathologist to get the biopsy right on the edge where you're getting some normal tissue along with the abnormal tissue. And that helps them get to a better diagnosis. So we do what's called a punch biopsy, and these dogs do very well. Then you also have a muscle disease where you have myositis. That's where, if you've seen them, dogs, usually large breed dogs, and the head starts caving in on both sides. That is also an immune-mediated disease, and there's some testing for that as well. We used to have to test by muscle biopsy. Now it can be tested with a blood test. So talk to your veterinarian, but that also is something that is controllable. Now, just so you know, you want to catch it early if you can, if you start seeing it happen. Why? Because you can never build the muscle back up, but you can stop the process at where it is. So these dogs are totally fine, but sometimes if left alone, it gets so bad that they get to the point where the muscles of masticatory myositis, those are the muscles of mastication, of chewing, the muscle gets destroyed and becomes like a tension band and they can't open their mouths. So if you see it happening, important to see your veterinarian, get a diagnosis as soon as possible And to have antibody test, you can send it to the lab. They can make a diagnosis and start treating, sooner the better. And that will only help your dog. As I said, it may not grow back, but it will be feel good. Seems unwise to do chemo. Just so, I mean, it depends on the age of the cat. If the cat is really old and you just want to do something, then 100%. Prednisolone is better than nothing. But I would look at lomustine. I would look at some of the other oral medications that can be used. It could help as well. So I would say to speak to a veterinary oncologist, that would help. If a dog gets bitten, bleeding, but not deep, what should you do? So that's a great question. Depends how bad is bleeding. First of all, if it's a puncture, we don't want to sew punctures. So even if it's a small cut, we don't necessarily want to sew them. We want to make sure that they're not getting infected. Because the most important thing is, if you sew it and there's still infection in the deeper layers, then you're going to get a wicked abscess. So depending on how large the gap is, how large the actual bite is, how deep it is, all determines how you're going to control. Are you going to be very aggressive with flushing and putting drains in and suturing? All right, but there you have a drain in there, so the drain can handle the oozing, the infection, the abscess, if it starts to abscess, all right, or treating it more conservatively. So these are many factors. I don't typically like, unless it's very large and gaping, to sew these small bite wounds. I like to clean them well, soap and water, maybe a Novasan, which is a chlorhexidine solution. Then we would have them compressed daily, put them on antibiotics, and let's see, usually these things close on their own as long as it's not too big. So it's important to see a veterinarian, and together, depending on how aggressive one needs to be, these things are off. I just had a bite wound too this week, and I just left them alone. They're already healing fine. Even my own bite wounds, I leave them alone. They heal. All right. Cause of a dog aggression in a group. Dog does doggy daycare. The last 2 days, it was aggression between dogs who know each other well. Ah, okay. Two are puppies. So when you have this, it's not necessarily, first of all, it may not be male, intermale aggression, though puppies that aren't neutered yet, it could be. I'd say it's a fight for dominance. It's a fight for toys. It's a fight for food, or it's a fight for another playmate. So if you have one such situation, you may need to separate. For example, there's also something called pack mentality. I have five dogs. If I walk them individually, they're not bad, especially three of the five. Two of them are obnoxious. My little Frenchie and my little Harry, which is my little terrier, probably one of my favorite. He gets nuts. But when I walk Tommy, my big Labrador alone, he's fine. I walk down the street to my friend's house, who has a very big dog. They play great together. But when I walk all five together, then that pack mentality kicks in, and they, any other dog, it could be a half a block away, across the street, and they all of a sudden start going nuts. Then my stupid little Frenchie, okay, he gets so crazy, then we get something called displaced aggression. What does that mean? He really wants to go with that dog across the street. He's all worked up. He's barking and yapping. And then Harry goes in for the kill, and he starts barking. Then Dwight starts to go after Harry. I mean, come on, really? They live together. They sleep together. They love each other. But they get so worked up. So you can't always predict when a dog gets that worked up how the behavior is going to be. And then once there's an aggression, by the way, between two dogs, and now if they know each other well, two of them are puppies. Well, if that happens, then now they have to get out of their minds. They have to go back to positive experiences with this dog, because if they see this dog again, they'd be ready to attack, to fight. So you may have to give them a timeout for a while from each other and reintroduce them, but not with a lot of noise and stuff going around when it's just the two of them, and hopefully get back to that situation where they're doing great. I'm going to answer one more question, and then we've got puppies learning how to behave. That's a good one too. And Eloise, who's, by the way, a great trainer, puppies have to learn to behave. And it's like with any, even little kids. So they annoy an older dog, right? And they get warning, but the puppies don't know how to listen. So we need to sometimes be there, prepared to intervene. Yes, Vicky, thank you. All right. Hi, Foster. Okay, let's go then. Before we hit to Shannon's question, let's take a quick break, and we'll come back after these messages. But we have to play our sponsor messages from our Pet Life Radio. So, Mark, take it away.
You know the expression, cats have nine lives. Well, what if you can give them one more? The Give Them 10 movement is on a mission to help give cats an extra life. How? With spay and neuter. Spaying or neutering your cat helps them live a longer, healthier life. And it helps control free-roaming cat populations too. Learn more about the benefits of spay and neuter and meet Scooter, the neutered cat, at givethem10.org. That's givethem10.org.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Back here live at Pet Life Radio, we're talking about IVDD, intervertebral disc disease, and is there a genetic component? How much can we know about it to maybe prevent breeding in dogs that have it? We do know certain breeds are notorious for it. I mentioned the long back dogs, like the corgis, like the dachshunds. And by the way, corgis and dachshunds also have a high predisposition to being overweight. So all that's doing is predisposing them to something they may already have a genetic predisposition. Now we put on added weight. No wonder it happens. And the same thing with French bulldogs. We're seeing a large amount of Frenchies with this disease, having surgery, et cetera. So obviously, I don't know if there's a test for it yet. I don't know if they've discovered the gene or genes that are responsible. But I do know if you have a line of dogs that are throwing IVDD, it's the same thing with German Shepherds with degenerative myelopathy. We know what happens, but do we know the connection from the genetic problem to the actual disease itself? Is there a genetic predisposition? I don't know. I don't know if anybody knows. I don't know if it's been tested yet. But it's just when something happens with certain breeds, then obviously the simple thought would be, yes, it's got to be somehow genetic. But we just don't. We don't know how to identify it. There's no test that can say, oh my God, this dog has it, therefore this dog should never breed. So, or does it take both parents? Is it a dominant or is it a submissive trait? We don't know. So we just don't know. So we have to be really careful to make sure that if you know a dog has it, it's like cryptorchidism in a dog. Nobody wants to breed a dog that is a monorchid or cryptorchid where the testicles don't descend because they know that it is passed on. But it can be passed on. Do we need both? All right. So the hard part is there's too much we know, there's a lot we don't know, at least know yet. So I would avoid breeding a dog first of all, hopefully they're spayed neutered anyway, but I avoid breeding a dog that whose offspring has shown to have IVDD, and at least that may be something we can do. So at what age should we start using glucosamine? Again, as I mentioned, there's no data to support that even works. The only data is coming from the clients, the pet parents, who are saying they've seen a change. So it's what we call empirical data. We have not proven it scientifically. There's been no study that I know of, because it would be very expensive to do MRIs or CTs on these animals. Radiographically, apparently, we don't see much of a change, if a change at all. But the pet parents are saying, no, I see a change in my dog. So if you have a large breed dog, especially a dog that we know has a tendency towards dysplasia, some sort of arthritis, and we know that the parents have had this problem, then you could start at any time. There's no downside. No studies that I know of that show a problem with using glucosamine, chondroitin, MSM. I have my dog on it, my big dog, my Labrador, every day, and he does fine. So I would say by the time they're middle age, maybe 5, 6, if they start showing signs before that, or if you take an x-ray for some reason and you already see arthritis starting, or you see poor conformation of the hip joint or the knees with whether it's medial patella luxation, whether it's cruciate, ligament, whether it's whatever, then I would start it whenever. I don't think there's a downside. Again, that's just me. Oh, it's a rescue cat. Well, I get it. If it's a rescue cat, then look, is prednisolone better than nothing? I think so. So do it. See what happens. Itchy dog who's had typical shots, chewing and head shaking, scratching, 3-year-old black lab. Okay, so what is better for an itchy dog besides typical shots? Chewing, head shaking. I'll start off with head shaking and scratching. Okay, and chewing. Chewing what? Chewing skin, chewing feet. If it's feet and head shaking and scratching, I would put food allergies on my list. I think that's very important because when we have face, feet, and ears, almost 3 Fs, then think of food allergy. There's a third F. So this time of year, a lot of allergies going on. It's fleas. Ears are often yeast infection, also predisposed by allergy. So you have to look at the ears, have the ears clean, treat the ears. When he says typical shots, are we talking Cytopoint? I don't know. Are we talking corticosteroid? That's important to know. But head shaking, well, I think the ears is part of the head shaking. So, and a three-year-old lab, I mean, that's when allergies can start easily. If the ears are bad, the rest of the body isn't that bad, and you're already on flea control, and there's no obvious signs other than the ears and head, I would think, like I said, I would think food. Otherwise, the allergy, treat for allergy should help as well. Bathing, Labradors get dry skin. So all of these can contribute. And most importantly, is it seasonal? If this wasn't happening in the winter, then I'm thinking seasonal allergy has nothing to do with food, because unless you're changing food seasonally, then it would most likely be allergies, seasonal allergies. If it's year-round, think of some sensitivity, hypersensitivity to something in the house, something they're always exposed to, or of course, their food. So you have to work it out, work it up more, but be very specific. When you see a veterinarian, you want to actually get a really thorough history, and those are the things they want to know. Has anything changed in the environment? Is this seasonal or is it not seasonal? Is the dog shaking, is rubbing its face on the carpet, for example? How are the teeth? Are there fleas? What does the rest of the skin look like? So these are things that are very important to determine whether or not. Now, mind you, of dogs that are allergic, only about 15 to maybe 20% is it food related. So food is not, it's overdiagnosed. It's not as common as everybody thinks, but it could be real. So you may want to talk to your veterinarian about a modified diet, something that is a protein diet that's novel. So novel protein and single antigen. So novel protein means a new protein, probably something the dog has never been exposed to before. I mean, weird proteins like bison and venison and rabbit and kangaroo and alligator and salmon and cod and tilapia. Stay away from poultry and beef, all right? Duck is a good one. So you want to get them on slowly and look for a food with only one antigen, protein antigen, and only one grain. Stay away from corn and wheat. Those are overrepresented. They've been exposed to it for too long. So look for, even rice I'm not a big fan of, but quinoa, barley, oats, vegetables, green pea, sweet potato, potato. So there are many other things that you can do that are carbs and proteins that the dog has probably never been seen before. And therefore, if he's never been exposed to it, he's most likely not going to be allergic to it, at least not yet. After 6 months, you never know. It could happen again. Okay, speaking of anal glands, if a dog gets anal glands done, but it's still constantly scooting, no worms, 5 months old, what's wrong? Ah, so again, some dogs, in fact, I'll be doing one coming up pretty soon. It is just the dog. And we therefore may need to remove the anal glands, kind of like removing skunk's glands. And if it's continuing all the time, normally dogs are able to release, evacuate their glands when they defecate. But if the anal secretion is super thick, or they don't have that sphincter muscle at the end of the bowel movement to really push it out, this is what happens. And also, maybe have your veterinarian or your veterinary staff do the, when you take it to a groomer, they're doing the easy way, which is just gland against gland. It's not as effective. The digital technique, you go put a glove on, go up the butt and do one gland at a time. That is a better way, more efficient way to splash the anal glands. You may want to do that first before deciding whether or not you need to be more aggressive. That's what I think. And Steph, how you doing? I hope you're still there. Husband's skeptical about dogs eating anal glands express. Oh, if it's never done, then no, some hot stuff. Trust me, you need to have it done and have it done by your veterinarian. Well, I don't know why they're skeptical about getting anal glands expressed, but sometimes it's a vicious cycle. If you don't do it and they start to fill up and build up, the fluid part of it gets resorbed, leaving a very thick, impossible to release by itself anal discharge. So you got to get them clearly expressed well, and then start making a decision about what to do, how to do it. So I would 100% do it. Okay, I think we got them. All right. If there's anyone I missed, please send me a note. We will do it. We'll take it. I'll be first one we do next week. But right now, we are over our time limit. When I get dirty looks from Mark, I know it's time to finish up. So anyway, thanks for joining me here. You can always reach me if you have a real problem during the week. You can reach me at drjeff, drjeff at petliferadio.com, drjeff at drjeff.com. A million ways you can get me on AirVet. So however you want to get me, get me. And also do me a favor, we had a great audience today. Tell your friends. It would be great to have more of your friends, more pet parents. I love talking to pet parents. With a new crop of people coming in, that's going to be a new crop of questions and problems we're having. and we can help people. If I can help you, I'm helping somebody else at the same time, and that makes me very happy. So, same bad time, same bad channel. I'm here next week, and have a wonderful week, everybody, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Let's Talk Pets, every week on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com.